Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joined with James Corbett of the Corbett Report right after the first segment of today's program. So I'm going to get started with the market report today for Thursday, June 8th, 2017. Once again, thank you for joining me this afternoon for the first 20 minutes, and of course, James Corbett and Alfred in the next for the balance of the program. We had a little bit of a pullback today in gold, and you know, I think it's a healthy pullback. I mean, it has gone from you know, about 1278 just from a week ago, and we were looking at it passing over 1300. There was all kinds of reports. We were seeing as 1300 had been seen as imminent. So I think today was a little bit of a good pullback. I think what we saw was maybe a little bit of profit taking today. The COMEX August gold had a big drop. The contract had hit its highest level since mid-March. And there was a couple of New York-based traders had commented that it's hard to tell whether the move was triggered by a single large seller or if it was, and it's hard to tell because all of these futures trades are done primarily electronic. So it's kind of hard to see exactly what is going on. But nothing has changed, and I don't see any more a larger pullback. Now, we do have the Fed meeting next week. You know, if they do raise rates, you might see a knee-jerk reaction, you know, I think, in the gold price. You know, contract expirations will be coming up shortly thereafter. But I think there's enough going on here and around the world that I think you'll see it stabilize and continue to work its way upward. So gold today, with all that said, gold today was down $9 at $1,278. The low was $1,271. We had a high of $1,285. So we're right in the middle at $1,278. Silver was down 18 cents today at $1,748. Platinum was down 7 at $941. But palladium was up big. It recaptured all its loss from yesterday, almost 2.5%, up $19 at $850. The USDX today was stronger, 0.31 at 97.01. I'm not sure if that was any reflection on what was going on in the election over in the UK. I didn't think the results would actually be announced until about 5 o'clock our time. Their polls, I think, shut down at 10 England time, so they still have a little ways to go. Don't know if the pound had gotten a little bit stronger, but so we saw a little bit of strength in the dollar. Crude oil today was down 10 cents at 45.62. Paper markets today, we saw the Dow, I guess, hit another record today, 21,181, up 7. The NASDAQ was up 23 at 63.20. And the S&P, basically unchanged, 24.33. I didn't have a chance to, 10-year yield, up 0.02, 2.19%. And, of course, we saw the same kind of reduction in the euro. A little bit more than the dollar was up, down 0.42 at 112. European and Asian markets were basically really flat overnight. Very little, you know, a few points here and a few points there. And all eyes, of course, was on the testimony today. And I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, watched or listened to the testimony of the former FBI Director James Comey today in Washington. From what little time I had to listen, it seems they are no closer to assessing the situation as whether it was collusion or any obstruction charges against the president. Certainly, there's more that there is no collusion, and although there were closed-door testimony held this afternoon. And if for a brief recap of the testimony, Mr. Comey says it was his judgment he was fired because of the Russian investigation. He was fired in some way to change or the endeavor was to change the way the Russian investigation was being conducted. Comey said that is a very big deal, and not just because it involves me. Comey also accused the Trump administration of spreading lies, plain and simple, about him and the FBI in the aftermath of his abrupt firing last month. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia asked Comey the key question, do you believe this rises to obstruction of justice? I don't know, Comey said. That's Bob Mueller's job to sort that out. Trump's private attorney, Mark Kassowitz seized on Comey's affirmation that he told Trump he was not personally under investigation. The president has not yet publicly denied the specifics of Comey's accounts, but has broadly challenged his credibility, tweeting last month, Comey better hope there are no tapes of the conversations. I would have to think that everything in and out of that White House is taped one way or another. And we'll have to see how this all turns out. Under questioning today, Comey strongly asserted the intelligence community's conclusion that Russia did indeed meddle in the 2016 election. It was interesting. I was having dinner with my family last night, and a friend of the family is a court reporter in Annapolis. Last night when we were having dinner, I asked her she mentioned that she took a big case. And I kiddingly asked her if she was going to Washington for the Comey testimony. And she said, no, this case was a little more in Maryland, she says. But she went on to explain how the court reporting is done with this type of testimony that goes on for a day or so and is so important. She says there's a pool of court reporters who only take dictation for about an hour. She says then they are replaced, and they do this so that the recorded testimony is made immediately available immediately thereafter to the public. But she also added it makes it easier to adjust if needed. You don't have to go back hours of of testimony if something needs to be adjusted. And I looked at her, I thought, well, why would you adjust testimony? And I didn't know if she was kidding or not, and I don't think she was. And she says, well, the reporters will get bombarded with the attorneys because they'll want to change things if it doesn't sound like it's supposed to. And it's like, you know, we really just don't get any truth whatsoever. You know, it's kind of like, I know what he said, but that isn't what he meant, kind of a thing, so we're going to change it. And she says it drives them crazy, but they're repeatedly changing the court reporters in this type of a testimony, and I just thought it was a little interesting. But really, I was surprised that they, you know, can actually change, you know, the testimony if it didn't sound the way it was supposed to sound. That wasn't what he meant. But anyway, I'm going to be moving on since we're talking about the administration, the analysis of the administration's budget by the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. And that was the school in which Mr. Trump had graduated. They found that the budget's cuts infrastructure spending overall by $55 billion. Over 10 years, Trump's budget does allocate $200 billion of federal money for infrastructure spending, but it also cuts $255 billion in existing infrastructure programs. So, it's just another day in Washington, and, and again, this is what you have when you have, when they've created this huge illusion, and when you have so much debt and you have all these programs, they really can't cut. They have to continue to go deeper in debt. They're going to print until the cows come home, until it actually collapses on itself, or there is some sort of outside event that takes it all down. A long time client called me today. It's been a while. He always calls and keeps in touch with me, and we were talking about what was going on in the world today. And he says, I can remember a very, very long time. He says, I'm talking about years ago. He says, you said that we would be going to war with North Korea. And I says, well, I still stick by that prediction that was made a long time ago. So you see, folks, when you make predictions, they don't have to come true in a month or a couple of weeks. You know, it's, you know, I look at the long term to determine what my predictions are going to be. Anything can happen from day to day. Lowe's is going to lay off another 120 tech workers in Mooresville. They're going to send those jobs to India. And Lowe's is trying to improve their profitability. So they're going to lay off 125 corporate tech workers. And this is at their headquarters in Mooresville, North Carolina. Many of the affected information technology job functions are being sent to Bangalore, India, where Lowe's employs approximately 1,000 people in information and technology and analytics. Wednesday's layoffs are just the latest in several rounds of reductions they've had over the last year. If you remember, Lowe's eliminated about 96 corporate tech jobs in October. In January, they cut another 2,400 full-time jobs, mostly at the store level. In February, it followed through with more than 500 corporate layoffs, including 430 at its headquarters in Mooresville and 70 support staffers in Wilkesboro. So the chief information officer, Paul Ramsey, said that the staffing reductions are part of a planning effort that began several years ago to build a more diverse global team to respond better. This highly competitive 24/7 retail environment and more quickly to evolving consumer needs. Bangalore has been described as the Silicon Valley of India. And there are other major corporations that are beginning to have a very big growing presence in the IT hub, including Oracle, Dell, IBM, GE. According to recent stories, there is another Wipro, an outsourcing firm used by Observer parent McClatchy. So they're creating and they're building their own Silicon Valley in India. And so again, we see these jobs continuing to leave. There's nothing to keep them here. And, you know, we can tax them to bring the products back into the States. But that means your prices are going to go up. And I think, and I've wanted to talk a little bit about debt here in just a little bit, but there were also other layoffs today as the merger between Yahoo and AOL is being completed. There was an announcement of up to 1,000 jobs that are expected to be lost. This is both across the AOL and Yahoo. That's less than about 20% of the combined company. I would expect to see a lot more in the coming months. You know, 20% when you're combining a company that basically, you know, does the same thing. Yeah, you're going to see more coming here through. But we know the merger between the two companies after Verizon bought both in succession to add tech and content to its mobile services is expected to be completed in the next week. The shareholder meeting to approve the deal takes place tomorrow. And so again, there's more job losses and I would expect many more coming our way. 37% of Americans. I mean, we talk about this on the program all the time. You know, your parents, my parents, their parents always thought that their children would have a better life. They would be better off financially than parents. Only 37% of Americans, 37% of Americans think that children in the United States will grow up to be better off financially than their parents. This is according to a new study by the Pew Research Center. Russians, since Russians always is in the news, let's bring in the Russians. The Russians, meanwhile, they have a more optimistic outlook, with 52% saying they believe their kids will be better off. You know, so we're truly seeing the redistribution of wealth. Even, you know, we're just seeing, you know, our country going down as the standard of living and other countries rising. More than half of the respondents in countries with fast-paced economic growth, such as India, Ghana, Nigeria, the Philippines, they all said they expected their kids to be better off. And here we are at only 37%. The U.S. may be one of the richest countries, or perhaps the biggest debtor in the world, but Americans are fairly pessimistic about their children's economic prospects for the future. So, again, it's, you know, that doesn't seem like there's a lot of hope there. You know, it seems like there's a lot of people that feel that our country is going to continue to decline no matter what happens. No matter how many jobs are promised us, no matter how much trillions of dollars are spent on infrastructure, no matter how many jobs that are being promised to come back to this country, you know, we continue to see the old system continue to go. And not a lot of hope when you have 37% of Americans only think that their kids are going to be better off financially than them. I guess it depends on how much money the parents leave the kids too. But there's an article by a commentary, I should say, by a Danielle Park. I thought it was kind of interesting. It was financial fragility is reaching a critical mass. She says that there are several key factors that have contributed to the financial fragility of the masses in our economy today. And I only have 2 more minutes left of my big 20-minute segment. And I do want to talk about our special today, and then I'll continue this. And I am going to post it in our weekly newsletter, so you can sign up for our weekly newsletter by going to the website, dgscoins.com, and it comes out on Monday afternoon, and I am going to post this in there because I find it interesting about, and it's about debt, and it's about the workers with the stagnating incomes, and we'll see if we can't talk about it with Al tomorrow. I always say that, and then Al and I go off on something else. But the 90% silver special, the $25 face value, has been, everyone is very interested in that. It's priced where it's very affordable, and I'm going to continue it, but the price did rise a little bit, $350. The interest has been strong, and $25 face value, these are going to be quarters, $350. It includes your shipping costs. If you wanted to add a 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle, that package also went up in price, $495. So I had to readjust them, and that's how long it's been since I adjusted these numbers, and we've seen both gold and silver move up significantly. $350 for a $25 face value of quarters, and tack on a 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle, it's $495, and it does include all your shipping costs and insurance, and I still have a few of those 1 ounce Canadian maple leaves that are left at $40 over spot. So stay tuned. Alfred and James Corbett will be with you in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, The Corbett Report. Some of the best podcasts, articles, videos on economics and issues of geopolitics that you can find on the internet are at Corbett Report, and here's James Corbett, our guest. Well, James, how are you doing?
I can't complain.
I heard that before. is that something you picked up from the Japanese? Is that what the Japanese say?
No. No, not really. It's just my nature.
Yep. How long have you been in Japan now?
This would be the, 13th year.
Uh-huh. I'm going to assume that you like the food.
Oh, I can definitely, I can get along with the Japanese food, and it gets along with me, so no problems there.
Do you think the Japanese food is healthier, as healthy, or less healthy than what you could expect to find in Canada or the United States?
Well, let's put it this way. The longest-lived people in the world come from the Japanese islands, so they must be doing something right, at least with the traditional Japanese diet. But, of course, as you can imagine, that is changing quite rapidly, and to the point where children, younger people today, are growing up on a lot of the same foods you would get in the U.S. in a lot of the same places, McDonald's and other fast food outlets like that have become much more popular with the younger generations. And as a result, you have the old stereotype of Japanese people being very short is not really that true anymore. I walk around the streets here and I am, if anything, maybe a little bit above average, but there are certainly always people who are taller than me walking around. And it's quite noticeable. I think there's a definite change taking place in dietary habits here. And
protein.
Part of that's just the general food chain production supply chain that's arisen in recent years. In fact, in recent decades, Japan has gone from a nation that primarily fed itself from its own food sources to a nation that primarily the majority of the food is imported. So there you go.
You know, the United States is somewhat similar to that, if I understand correctly. It used to be we fed everybody, including ourselves. Now we are importing a significant percentage of our food. And I don't know that I like that, to tell you the truth. I would feel much better if we were independent and providing our own food. Do you feel the same way about Japan?
Oh, absolutely. I think in the event of any large-scale international disruption, Japan would definitely feel the effects of that because of the dependence that it has grown into over the past century and a half of being opened to the outside world. It has certainly become a part of the international supply chain through food and energy and other resources that are now heavily imported. And that's exactly why, I mean, even something like World War I or World War II scenario, obviously quite disruptive to Japan, but even more so, such a situation in this day and age, precisely because of factors like that.
I saw an article in CNN Money, and the headline is, Japan racks up longest growth streak in over a decade. Is Abenomics working?
That is not the way I would put it, but I guess there's a sense in which you could.
I'm sure that's how the ruling party is going to put it.
Yeah. Well, of course, absolutely.
They'll take credit for anything good. You know, if it's good, we did it.
Yeah. Well, exactly right. And that's the way politics rolls here and everywhere else in the world. I wouldn't say that it's Abenomics that is doing this as much as Abe would like to claim credit for it. I think it is the outright intervention in the Japanese economy generally, including in the bond market, including in the stock market, of the Bank of Japan, which people might know has taken a very lead role, not only in outright purchasing securities, bonds from the Japanese government, becoming actually disruptive in the Japanese bond market space, where it's becoming more difficult. The question of them being able to continue not only growing, but even maintaining their bond purchases is in question, given they're sort of running out of room in the bond market, as even major banks are leaving the market because there's just no money to be made in it anymore. But also in the stock market, where the Bank of Japan is becoming one of the major shareholders in dozens and dozens of corporations in Japan. It's quite a remarkable intervention, and as a result, yes, there have been some short-term economic gains, I suppose you could call them that, that really at base are just central bank interventions and just a kind of creation of easy credit is ultimately what this is about. And I think it will come back to bite Japan in the posterior at some point, but for the time being, of course, the prime minister is going to try to ride that wave and pretend that he did it himself.
Is this the sort of thing that's a certain amount, is this inadvertent? Is this a consequence? You know, they're trying to stimulate the economy, yes, but they didn't really plan on buying a bunch of corporations. Or is this evidence of a coming fascist system where government is tied to corporations in a way similar to what was once seen in Nazi Germany?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put Japan in a particularly unique spot with this. Oh, I think central bank interventions are becoming more and more a part of the economic status quo around the world. And if anything, rather than some sort of new emergence of some new form of fascism, I think this is maybe just a consummation of a marriage that's been around for quite a while. Clearly, the central banks have been that player behind the scenes that most people don't look at or think about when they're talking about the economy, but clearly is the third man, the middleman, in every single transaction that's taking place in an economy by setting the quote-unquote price of money with interest rates. They are the ones that are steering this ship, and now it's becoming more and more overt as they take these very overt measures, like literally buying up stocks and becoming shareholders in Japanese corporations. That's quite a dramatic move, but I think it's really just a further step along a spectrum rather than some sort of fundamentally new phenomenon.
Is it something they're doing that's just an unintended event? It's kind of a, I don't know, collateral damage, if you want to call it, or must they do it? Are they caught in a position where they must buy more and more stock in order to hold this together?
Well, given, yes, I mean, they've painted themselves into a corner. If the desire is to maintain the status quo, then clearly this is the direction that the Bank of Japan had to go in. I don't think there was any other way to keep all of the balls in the air. Something was going to give, so they had to basically start monetizing, and monetize they have. And I think that's the logic of the situation, and I think in order to maintain the system as it is, that's what they had to do, and so that's what they did. The question is there anything else they could have done or will do to get themselves out of this now that they've painted themselves into that corner? And I personally don't see a way out of it. As usual with these types of bubbles, and that's essentially what this is, the only way out is to grow yourself out, and I don't see any gigantic growth in the actual real productive economy in Japan, any sort of new technology or new industries that are coming along, other than perhaps you could argue robotics, and Japan still maintains something of an edge in that industry, but I'm not sure that's going to be enough.
Melody was wondering if you followed Venezuela at all. Is it something that you kind of keep up on, or is it off your radar?
I really don't know enough to be able to speak in detail about.
Good, then I'll ask you her question anyway. She was wondering. It's strange that in the midst of all their financial problems and political problems and so on in Venezuela, the stock market has actually been rising. Do you have an explanation for that? Do you think it's just because they anticipate the dollars, or I don't know what they use, if a bolivar is their currency, I don't recall, but their currency is going to go through so much inflation that people are just dumping it, give me something, anything. I know I'm going to lose if I hang on to this currency, so give me stock. I'll take some stock.
Mm.
You think yes, that's describing it or something
it
else?
It is a perplexing phenomenon, but correct me if I'm wrong, the Venezuelan stocks are denominated in bolivars. So as the bolivar as the bolivar devalues, then the stock market might actually expand because there are more of these increasingly valueless toilet paper notes that are floating around in it. So I would assume that has something to do with it. It's not the the absolute value, you know, as measured in, say, in U.S. dollars. It is this kind of, you know, the devaluing bolivar currency, which is making it inflated, you know, in comparison to itself, but not in comparison to its relation to outside currency.
I'm thinking that, and I don't know this to be true, but I'm thinking that there are currency controls that prevent money from leaving Venezuela. And if that's true, and if they were caught, they think there's going to be significant inflation, more as much or more than they have right now, then, all right, fine, I will get rid of these bolivars and I will buy stock with them. Because in the end, ultimately, I think the stock may have some value where the bolivar may have none.
Or
is
at any rate,
stock
the stock
in this dirty shirt?
Yeah, or at any rate, people might think the stock might be able to retain its value in current terms, whereas the currency will go on deflating, something along those lines. And that might be part of that. As far as I know, there is the bolivar to dollar exchange is controlled by the Venezuelan government. So if you do want to get your money out of bolivars, you have to either go through the government or, as I think is more common, go through the black market. And I think the black market
is another part of the government, probably.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of dipping and corruption that goes on there, as always. And that's, I think, another reason why Bitcoin, wouldn't you know it, took off in Venezuela last year as people were trying to find ways around these currency restrictions.
You've done an article on Monsanto employing a troll army to silence online dissent. Wasn't that your article?
Yes, I was writing about that recently.
I think it was 6 weeks ago, something like that.
Yes.
Let nothing go. That's Monsanto's. Right. They're hiring trolls to go after anyone who criticizes Monsanto products, including Roundup, the most widely sold chemical product on the face of the earth, other than gasoline, probably. I may be exaggerating, but
it is now officially the most best-selling agricultural chemical in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there what? How strong is the evidence that it contributes to cancer?
Strong enough that it is now being tried before the U.S. District Court in San Francisco. And for people who don't know about this, I wrote about this in more depth a few months ago now, that there is this essentially a class action suit that's happening. Or at any rate, there were a number of different lawsuits that have been raised. Basically, people either directly or through a family member who's passed away claiming that the cancer, lymphoma, a non-Hodgkin lymphoma, was caused by Roundup. That's the most common complaint. And this is on the back of, I want to say last year, it might have been 2015, in which the World Health Organization added Roundup to its list of possible, or was it probable, human carcinogens, which was a major move because the EPA in the United States has long resisted that classification. And so there was a court wrangling over this. People were suing Monsanto. They rolled all of those lawsuits up into one giant 50 different lawsuit trial that's going on in San Francisco right now, and that's where this is all taking place. And as a result of that, we're seeing some very interesting documents coming out of Monsanto and the EPA as well. And that's what I was writing about a few months ago, that documents are showing how the EPA and the people who were in charge of the EPA's cancer board or whatever, where they actually make that classification as to what is a carcinogen or not, were, lo and behold, highly involved with Monsanto and corresponding with them and trying to basically massage the data to help Monsanto's case. And you had one whistleblower from within the EPA who actually was writing letters or emails or letters that have now come out as part of this trial to her superior at the time. She had to eventually leave because she herself had cancer. And in one particularly poignant email, she's talking about how she wants to see the truth about this come out before she herself dies of cancer. And she did end up dying of cancer, I believe, last year. So it's quite dramatic documents that are coming out. And one of them is, as you point to, this Let Nothing Go campaign that is at least mentioned in some of these documents that have been obtained by a whistleblower organization, a food safety organization called U.S. Right to Know. And in this, they have an allegation that they've put before the court that says Monsanto even started the aptly named Let Nothing Go program to leave nothing, not even Facebook comments, unanswered through a series of third parties. It employs individuals who appear to have no connection to the industry, who in turn post positive comments on news articles and Facebook posts defending Monsanto, its chemicals, and GMOs. So some very interesting things coming out, and it will be interesting to see how this proceeds. As usual, I'm not necessarily holding my breath for the U.S. and justice system to really come to the right conclusion here, but at any rate, we might see some interesting documents and details emerge.
Do you know whose idea it was to combine all 50 of these lawsuits into a single case? Or did that come from Monsanto? They said, look, we've got a bunch of these things. Let's do them all in one place. Did it come from the plaintiffs? Did it come from the courts? Do you know?
I don't know that, no.
I'm curious if you think that combining all 50 lawsuits together, is that a good idea from Monsanto's perspective or a bad idea? Did they get more discovery? In other words, if they sued you in one case and they had to deal with me in another case and somebody else, I might discover a few pieces of the puzzle and you might discover a few and someone else might discover a few. But the only ones they'd hear in court are the ones, in my case, that I discovered. But if they try us all at the same time, they're going to hear all of that evidence. Whatever you might have dug up, that's going to be there. Whatever I dug up, that's going to be there. Whatever the other guy dug up, that's going to be there. Does our case against Monsanto grow by virtue of having 50 plaintiffs?
I think there are pros and cons on both sides of this, for both sides, the prosecution and the defense, as to having them balled up like this. And one of them that might be a con on the Monsanto side would be that it does present a single target for journalists and other would-be meddlers who want to publish truth to concentrate on. If there were 50 separate lawsuits with individuals, it might be more difficult to keep your eye on all of the information emerging, but here it's all in one centralized place, and there is even a website maintained by the U.S. District Court in San Francisco dedicated to the case and the various documents that are being filed as a result of it. So it certainly is easier to track that, but on the flip side of that, I suppose there's going to be one singular ruling that comes out of this, and if at any point the judges rule that these people don't have standing or the case doesn't have grounds to proceed, then all of these lawsuits can be thrown out at once. On the other side, generally speaking, when there is a finding of guilt in a case like this, if there is such a finding, then it would probably be, I mean, they're going to have to coordinate that at some point. You couldn't have 50 different rulings with different...
No, it's got to be the same fundamental idea.
Exactly.
In all 50 of them. And they'll rule on that. We'll see what happens. But to me, it looks Monsanto. I would think Monsanto's in some trouble here. We're going to take a break for a couple commercials. I'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold. gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is calling in from Japan, and we are talking about various subjects. Some are economic, some are geopolitical, some of them are just a little bit odd. Like, here's one that's a little bit, to me, interesting. From Fox News, and the headline is, Comey to testify that Trump sought loyalty, asked to lift Russia cloud. Okay, headline out just today. What I want to talk to you about is loyalty. What do you think? Is loyalty a good thing, in your opinion?
It's a very broad question.
See, the reason I'm asking is this. When someone asks for loyalty, they're not asking you to stand by them if they do the right thing.
Right.
We expect you to stand by. If I'm doing the right thing, I expect you to stand by and support me. But yep. If I'm up to something a little nefarious,
exactly.
I want you to commit your loyalty to me.
That's
in
the
advance.
Point. Right. If someone is asking someone else to break their ideals or go against their morals in order to adhere to this sense of loyalty, that's mm-hmm. clearly a sticky proposition and one that I don't think generally is supportable.
I agree. I think, and a lot of people think, oh, loyalty is a great thing. I think there's a danger in loyalty, and it's the sort of thing where if you're going to be a good man, if you're going to have honor, integrity, anything like that, it's all easy to talk about, hard to do. But if you intend to move in that direction, I think you can't have loyalty. You've got, your loyalty has to be to what's right rather than who is a member of your family, who lives on your block, who did you go to school with. Got to do the right thing. A lot of times that means disloyalty, someone you're associated with. If they did the wrong thing, you got to do the right thing, and they're going to criticize you being disloyal. And so in any case, saw the headline, crossed my mind, I thought I'd bring it up. Talk about Bitcoin a little bit. Senators in Congress have called for digital currency oversight in an anti-money laundering bill. Do you have any comment on that? How are things going for Bitcoin? I mean, they are just exploding. Prices rising, doubled in the month of May. How long can this keep
Yes, doubled in the month of May. It's gone up 600% since about 6 months ago. So it's really quite crazy at the moment. And, you know, I expect that what we are living through is a bit of a bubble period. And, in fact, there's a very technical thing about the Bitcoin network that and how it operates and a protocol change that's coming up on August 1st that is going to, I think, probably quite largely disrupt whatever kind of run Bitcoin is on right now. But that aside, it's certainly the fever rush that we've seen in recent weeks and months can be pinned down to some governmental decisions that have come in Russia and Japan, but perhaps most notably Japan, to treat Bitcoin as a form of currency that can now be used and traded and is not subject to capital taxes on capital accumulation or whatever that was the case in the past. Now it's treated as a currency, so we're starting to see a lot of retailers getting interested in it. So clearly, I think this is part of that buzz that it's going through right now. And in the United States, clearly the U.S. government has been looking at this and trying to control its sale and its spread for a number of years now, and we've seen people arrested for running essentially what's called money laundering schemes, but basically just allowing people to transfer in and out of Bitcoin through fiat currency. They are being called currency traders, and the government is asking to regulate them like that. So clearly, U.S. government wants to come out with some sort of definitive judgment, and that will affect the way this is run. And ultimately, it will be something, I imagine, like here in Japan and elsewhere, whereby they want to make it so that, yes, there will be a Bitcoin market and you can buy and sell Bitcoin, but in order to do so, it will have to be through a government-licensed exchange that will require, you know, 15 forms of ID before they'll do business with you. And I think that's the direction they're trying to steer this into.
But do you think they can make that happen? I'm understanding that there are something like 750 different varieties, according to Cliff High. He says there's 750 different varieties of cryptocurrency available right now. And I don't care what you write. You may pass a law for Bitcoin. How soon will we see another cryptocurrency spring up that defies the law, operates on the dark web? Yeah. I mean, is this something, can the government really push cryptocurrencies around, or is this an idea that's beyond their reach?
Well, you raise an important point, because I think Bitcoin has gone from something like 95% of the overall cryptocurrency market to down to 60, maybe even below 60%, and falling as other altcoins, as they're called, starts to step up and become larger markets like Ethereum and Dash and Monero. And each different coin offers its own catch, like, oh, this one is better for privacy, or this one is better for transactions, or whatever. So it's fascinating to watch.
I want the blue one.
Yeah.
I don't want the red ones. I want the blue ones.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is interesting to watch that taking place, and I think that does gesture towards the fact that this idea, I mean, fundamentally, there's no way they're going to be able to prevent people from transacting in Bitcoin or whatever directly between two people. I just don't think that the government can ever possibly control and monitor all of that. What they can do is just make it so difficult that, like anything else, I mean, of course, the government can't stop you from, buying something from someone in cash or paying someone under the table and not paying taxes. It happens all the time. We know that happens. But it is technically illegal, and it becomes a gray market or a black market activity that, you know, has to be circumscribed, and it will never overtake the real economy, but it might be a significant subsection thereof. And that's interesting, an interesting phenomenon. And I think ultimately this puts it into, rather than thinking of it as something brand new, some 21st century thing we've never seen, it's just like any other black market or gray market that's come up before. There are going to be ways around government restrictions, and if you follow them, that will technically make you a criminal.
Assuming you can be caught and identified.
Indeed.
Yeah, even if you can't, that's another problem. And again, we're dealing with a kind of wave here. It's like a thousand illegal immigrants are running across the border at the same time, and you've only got 20 border guards. You're not going to catch very many of the thousand. Even if it's illegal, they all come in mass, guess what? You're not going to be able to catch them very, very easily. Do you think the Japanese government, when they recognize or prepared to recognize Bitcoin, are they doing it because they think it's the way of the future and they think this is a positive development, or are they simply bowing to the inevitable and they're saying, look, there's nothing we can do, we might as well go along with the program?
Well, I think co-optation is a key strategy that's always used. And when an idea comes along, the idea isn't necessarily to squash that idea. It's how can we use this for our own purposes? And I think governments and other oligarchs are always looking for ways to do that in all sorts of things. And things like this are no exception.
I think it was Hillary Clinton and Rahm Emanuel who said something about a an alt currency is a terrible thing to waste. Isn't that what they said?
Yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, every crisis can be used as an opportunity.
Got a headline here from 24H Gold. Fort Knox looted 7,000 tons of gold in 1973 through 1974, says 1981 article. Somebody found a 1981 article, newspaper article, that alleged that Fort Knox had been looted of 7,000 tons of gold from 1973 to 74. Do you think the United States Treasury, I think they claim to have about 8,200 tons of gold, do you think they've still got it? There's mixed opinion on it. Where do you come down on it?
Well, actually, the question isn't even necessarily whether it is still physically there. It's who actually owns it and in what way, and who believes they have what gold. As we saw, of course, with the repatriation of the German gold and other moves on that front in recent years, it is not always simply a question of someone saying, okay, so this is the gold, and here it is in this vault, and we'll just take it. Why is it more difficult than that? Why is it more complicated? Could it be that this gold is being used? It actually has several people who believe that they own it, and ownership has to be clarified? Is it being resold or relent out or leased?
But still sitting
parties,
in the same vault.
But still sitting there, physically sitting there, because no one wants to take possession of, you know, a ton of gold or whatever. It's obviously too much. So you leave it in the vault, but a lot of people might claim ownership over this or that piece. So it's not even just a question of whether it's physically there, but who physically owns it is another question altogether. As to whether, how much is in the vaults at Fort Knox or whatever, I would only be able to speculate. I would be surprised if all of the gold that they say is there, but you never know. But then again, it could just be because they've sold it out many times over.
There was a story broke probably 4, maybe 5 years ago, I don't recall clearly. China discovered that they'd taken a bunch of gold bars in payment for something, and I believe they ultimately traced them back. I don't know if it was directly from the United States government or the bars were traced back to the United States government. They were discovered to have tungsten cores and essentially just a gold plating. Now, it implies that there was a big to-do about that for a little while, and then everybody just went quiet. Do you think it's because China didn't want to admit that many of its gold bars were actually tungsten?
That's certainly one thing that you have to keep in mind, whoever's holding the bag with the counterfeit currency, whether it's counterfeit gold or anything else, is the one who ultimately pays the price for it. And
unless he keeps his mouth shut.
Unless you pass it on to the next sucker. So, yes, I mean, that's something that people have to be aware of in the precious metals markets. It happens at the small level as well as the big level. And, when governments get caught with egg on their face, it could be particularly embarrassing.
There is a book out called Gold Warriors, if I recall correctly. I haven't read the book. Gold Warriors, it alleges that as a result of World War II, the Japanese stole an incredible amount of gold from China, which they ultimately hid in numerous different dumps in the Philippines and maybe elsewhere. And the book alleges that there is far more gold available in the world than people believe right now. Now, do you think that's a credible claim? Do you think that the Chinese could have been hiding so much gold that there might be, say, 3 times as much gold in the world as people suppose? Or is this just a fiction novelist's clever idea?
Well, I haven't read the book that you're referring to either, but I am familiar with it and have certainly heard about it and its thesis. And I haven't done the research directly myself, so I don't know the veracity of it. It certainly wouldn't surprise me. I do believe that something like that certainly could have and probably did take place. To what extent and how much gold and where it really rests now might be another matter. And I know on the back of those claims, which I believe to have been fairly well documented and researched, but on the back of those claims, people have made very outlandish kind of claims about, the World Bank or whatever is going to sign over this gold to humanity, mm-hmm. and they're going to, and all this kind of stuff, and that seems complete nonsense and nothing to back it up. So I'm wary about things where there is a base level of reality that people build upon with their fantasy land stuff, but that doesn't discredit the base level of reality there. I think there probably is that level of manipulation in the precious metal markets with gold, and those types of intrigues absolutely do happen. Again, in this particular case, I haven't done enough research to be able to talk about it in detail, but certainly something like that seems at least feasible and could be part of the crypto politics that take place that explain events that otherwise don't really make sense to the outside world.
I've got one last question for the last 2 minutes of the program. This is from News Target, and the headline is, Trump orders nationwide preparation against power grid collapse initiated by cyber warfare. Is this a credible idea? Do we have to fear the power grid going down due to cyber warfare? If so, who's going to do it?
Very good questions. Yes, I mean, ultimately in this age, and especially now as we're moving into the age of the smart grid and things are increasingly becoming more and more wired in together, the possibility, or at least the vulnerability of these power grids and other critical infrastructure to cyber attacks is there. And I, being the conspiratorial sort, believe that that is at least part of actually the long-term plan, because I do believe that a false flag in the cyber realm, even if it is not necessarily done by the government to itself, but certainly it could just be allowed to happen or encouraged to happen by building vulnerabilities into the system. And that would, I mean, exactly as we know, the Patriot Act was written and waiting to be tabled in front of Congress before 9/11 took place. We know that. Well, also, we also know from Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard professor who's talked about it, he said Richard Clark has told him there is an iPatriot Act that is waiting to be tabled in the event of a major I-9/11. So we know that this is already waiting, and we know that the ruling powers, the powers that shouldn't be, have no compunction about allowing or fostering or encouraging or committing these types of attacks in order to get the response that they want. It's a really
so we better get ready them. Because it may be we're going to have to find a way to run my internet connection with a hand crank. Is that true?
It could come down to that. I don't think
we're going to have to let it go at that, James, because we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Always enjoy talking to you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Well, Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd the producer, and James Corbett. Night.
Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.